Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Friday, the 14th of June, these are our main stories. The United States has accused Iran of being behind the attacks on two tankers in the Gulf of Oman. It says it will defend its interests in the region. Sudan's ruling military council has admitted for the first time that it ordered the deadly clearance of a pro-democracy protest. The White House press secretary, Sarah Sanders, is to leave her post at the end of this month. Also in this podcast,
zebras erect their black hairs whilst their white hairs remain flat and close to the skin.
So, are the stripes of a zebra really part of the animal's air conditioning? The United States has accused Iran of carrying out attacks on two tankers in the Gulf of Oman on a vitally important shipping route for oil exports. The US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo addressed reporters at the State Department in Washington on Thursday. Here's his speech.
It is the assessment of the United States government that the Islamic Republic of Iran is responsible for the attacks that occurred in the Gulf of Oman today. This assessment is based on intelligence, the weapons used, the level of expertise needed to execute the operation, recent similar Iranian attacks on shipping, and the fact that no proxy group operating in the area has the resources and proficiency to act with such a high degree of sophistication. This is only the latest in a series of attacks instigated by the Islamic Republic of Iran and its surrogates against American and allied interests. And they should be understood in the context of 40 years of unprovoked aggression against freedom-loving nations. On April 22nd, Iran promised the world that it would interrupt the flow of oil through the Strait of Hormuz. It is now working to execute on that promise. In early May, the Revolutionary Guard Corps attempted the covert deployment of modified dhows capable of launching missiles. On May 12th, Iran attacked four commercial ships near the Strait of Hormuz. On May 14th, Iran-backed surrogates attacked by armed drones struck two strategically important oil pipelines in Saudi Arabia. On May 19th, a rocket landed near the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. On May 31st, a car bomb in Afghanistan wounded four U.S. service members, killed four Afghan civilians, and wounded bystanders. Yesterday, Iranian surrogates fired a missile into Saudi Arabia, striking the arrivals terminal of an international airport, injuring 26 people. Taken as a whole, these unprovoked attacks present a clear threat to international peace and security, a blatant assault on the freedom of navigation, and an unacceptable campaign of escalating tension by Iran. Prime Minister Abe made a historic trip to Iran to ask the regime to de-escalate and enter into talks. Iran's supreme leader rejected Prime Minister Abe's diplomacy today by saying he has no response to President Trump and will not answer. The supreme leader's government then insulted Japan by attacking a Japanese oil tanker just outside of Iranian waters, threatening the lives of the entire crew, creating a maritime emergency. Iran's foreign minister today responded to these attacks. He said sardonically, quote, "Suspicious doesn't begin to describe what likely transpired this morning," end of quote. Foreign Minister Zarif may think this is funny, but no one else in the world does. Iran is lashing out because the regime wants our successful maximum pressure campaign lifted. No economic sanctions entitle the Islamic Republic to attack innocent civilians, disrupt global oil markets, and engage in nuclear blackmail. The international community condemns Iran's assault on the freedom of navigation and the targeting of innocent civilians.
The incidents in the Gulf of Oman come at a time of high tension in the region, which escalated recently when the Americans tightened their sanctions on Iran. I asked our State Department correspondent Barbara Plett-Archer on what basis Mr. Pompeo had made these accusations against Iran.
He gave a list of grounds for why the U.S. made this assessment, and he said it was based on intelligence, on the weapons used, on the level of expertise needed to execute the operation, on similar Iranian attacks, as he called them, on shipping that happened recently in the region. And also he said on the fact that no proxy group in the area had the ability, the proficiency or resources to carry out such an attack. So taken all together, he said that they have concluded that Iran was responsible. But it is only the Americans who are making this sort of public assessment at the time. And of course, the Iranians have strongly denied it.
I mean, there are good reasons why people are concerned about how this might escalate. Let's hear what Mr. Pompeo had to say about how America is going to react now.
Our policy remains an economic and diplomatic effort to bring Iran back to the negotiating table at the right time, to encourage a comprehensive deal that addresses the broad range of threats. Threats today apparent for all the world to see, to peace and security. Iran should meet diplomacy with diplomacy, not with terror, bloodshed, and extortion. The United States will defend its forces, interests, and stand with our partners and allies to safeguard global commerce and regional stability. And we call upon all nations threatened by Iran's provocative acts to join us in that endeavor.
So, Barbara, from what we're hearing there, it suggests that some of the more hawkish elements within the administration who might favour going beyond mere sanctions are still in the minority.
Well, we know that President Trump has been quite eager to have talks with the Iranians. And in recent weeks, Mr. Pompeo has taken that up a little bit more as well. He said that the talks would be possible without any preconditions, at least to begin discussions. So that's been happening in recent weeks. And he hasn't backed down from that in this statement. He did say that they were continuing with the diplomatic and economic strategy, by that meaning attempts at talks, but also crippling sanctions. But he also made the point that this offer of talks, as delivered through the visiting Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, had been rejected by the Supreme Leader, who did in fact reject them based on the fact that the U.S. was squeezing them with sanctions, not to mention having just upped the sanctions on the petrochemical industry recently, so there was nothing to talk about. And also then President Trump chimed in with his own tweet saying, thanks, Prime Minister Abe, but I don't think we're anywhere close to a deal. They're not ready and we're not either. So that's where things stand at the moment. But you're not seeing any military rhetoric and you're not seeing at this point anyway a replay of sending military assets, boosting military presence in the region like you saw a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, just a reminder, Iran has denied any involvement and blamed the attacks on elements intent on damaging its relations with the rest of the world. For more on that, here's Barman Kalbasi from the BBC Persian Service in New York.
Well, other than what you read, which is we were set up, the idea that the Supreme Leader was meeting with the Prime Minister of Japan as this happened, given that one of the ships was Japan-owned, it is creating that sort of doubt even inside Iran, and especially from the point of view of the government, that this was an operation to embarrass them or make that trip unsuccessful. However, in that very meeting, the Supreme Leader of Iran said that he's not going to respond to any message that President of the United States had sent through the Japanese Prime Minister because it was America and this administration in Washington that has violated the nuclear deal, has brought back sanctions. He even pointed out that right before Prime Minister of Japan's trip to Iran, U.S. took another step in sanctioning Iran's petrochemical industry, which is huge, part of Iran's exports. So it was clear from the Iranian point of view that there is nothing to talk about to this administration as long as they are in violation of the deal of UN Security Council 2231. Yet to have this incident happen on the very same day, it does give them some leeway to at least argue that this seems something far-fetched from something they would do because there's nothing to be gained from it. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are others who argue that, in fact, Iran is now responding to the fact that the economic warfare, as they call it, and sanctions by the United States is putting them in a position where they have no choice but to respond. In fact, one former Pentagon official tweeted in the first thing in the morning that when you poke a country in the eye so long, at some point they're going to react, and this is to be expected.
That was Barman Kalbasi from BBC Persian. Well, in a statement, the British government said it agreed with the assessment of the United States that Iran was responsible for the attacks on those two tankers in the Gulf of Oman. Sudan's ruling military council has admitted for the first time that it did order the security forces to break up a protest camp 10 days ago, during which dozens of people were shot dead. Steve Jackson reports.
The spokesman for Sudan's transitional military council admitted that mistakes had been made in clearing the sit-in outside army headquarters in the centre of Khartoum. He expressed regret and said some officers had been arrested for their roles in the killings. He added that no further protest camps would be allowed near military bases. Earlier, prosecutors announced new charges against the former president, Omar al-Bashir, who was ousted in April. After being charged last month over the killings of protesters calling for him to step down, prosecutors have now accused him of corruption.
Steve Jackson. The relatives of two people who died in Uganda after contracting Ebola have been repatriated to the Democratic Republic of Congo. The two, a boy and his grandmother, were the first people to die of the disease in Uganda after the virus spread across the border. There have been over 2,000 cases in eastern DRC since the outbreak began there last August. Our Africa health reporter, Rhoda Odhiambo, says the Ugandan authorities in the border area remain on high alert.
After the second case, after the grandmother of the child died, what the government has done, it's banned public gatherings, so no more gathering for prayers, even market days. All this they're doing to control the spread of Ebola. They're also doing screenings at all entry points to ensure that anyone who's planning to enter Uganda at the airport or at the border points are screened. And from tomorrow, they're going to start giving out the vaccines to first responders on the scene and also people who are feared to have gotten Ebola. It's actually the first case to have moved from Uganda across border. And why it's been very difficult to deal with it, it's because when you look at the cultural issues and how Africans have been taking care of each other, we look at socialization, for instance. If you have someone who has Ebola and you can't tell the person that, do not take care of, for instance, your mother, could be your mother, your brother. There's also the issue of creating awareness and how people are informed about it. So maybe the information has been given out by the Ministry of Health and other implementing partners, but it's not trickling down to the communities on how best they can do to avoid the spread of Ebola and how best they can protect themselves.
That was our Africa health reporter, Rhoda Odhiambo. President Donald Trump's press secretary and spokeswoman, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, is to leave her job at the end of the month. Speaking at an event at the White House, Ms. Sanders said working at the White House had been a special experience.
The only one I can think of that might top it just a little bit is the fact that I'm a mom. I have three amazing kids, and I'm going to spend a little more time with them. And in the meantime, I'm going to continue to be one of the most outspoken and loyal supporters of the president and his agenda. And I know he's going to have an incredible six more years and get a whole lot more done. And thank you so much, Mr. President. It's truly an honor.
Great person. Thank you, Sarah. She's a warrior. We have to be warriors in this world, but she is a warrior. Thank you, Sarah, very much.
I heard more from the BBC's Gary O'Donoghue in Washington about Ms. Sanders' achievements and who might replace her.
She was in on this campaign before he became president. She was taken on board during 2016. She obviously has a deeply political background, given her father, Mike Huckabee, was governor of Arkansas for two terms. And she grew up steeped in Republican politics. And she went on to join the Trump campaign and became deputy to Sean Spicer, who was the first press secretary. You remember, he was a rather sort of hapless figure, having to defend the indefensible when it came to even the first couple of days of the administration with the row about the numbers who attended the inauguration. You remember those funny pictures of him appearing from the bushes once, do you remember as well?
I do.
So she took over from him, and she's been well liked by the president, and she's been absolutely staunch in her defence of him. But yeah, she's had some rocky times. The relationship with the press has been terrible in many ways, and she's had to sort of admit that she didn't quite tell it how it was in respect to the firing of James Comey, when she talked about having heard from countless FBI agents and then had to sort of row that back later on and say, well, that was a bit of a slip of the tongue. And she was criticised in the Mueller report for that.
And briefly, Gary, who takes over? Any sign?
No, not a moment. Press briefings, daily briefings are a thing of the past. I think we had a quick look and we think that the last one was perhaps back in March. But of course, the president does do a lot of these ad hoc press conferences of his own, standing by Marine One on the South Lawn, or when he gets on and off a plane, or he's constantly doing rallies. So he is out there quite a lot. And you know, it's not unreasonable, I think, to think that the president thinks he is his own best press secretary and what I call the communicator in chief. So I don't think there'd be any great rush to appoint someone new. And they may it may not be the job it once was.
Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. The BBC World Service's landmark podcast series, 13 Minutes to the Moon, is continuing to tell the story of the Apollo moon landings. Presenter Kevin Fong has been talking to the people who made it happen about how they overcame numerous problems and challenges before Neil Armstrong could make his first steps on the moon. In the episodes available so far, we've heard about how the average age of flight controllers was just 27 and the use of a brand new and relatively untested piece of technology, the computer. 13 Minutes to the Moon is a fascinating story behind one of the most iconic events of the 20th century. Just search for 13 Minutes to the Moon wherever you got this podcast. An ancient tower in the Afghan city of Ghazni has collapsed. Analysts say corruption, war, and neglect are all contributing to the destruction of Afghanistan's historic monuments. Jill McGivering reports.
The Ghaznian fort dates back more than 1,000 years. It was used as a military citadel and palace in the 10th century by Sultan Mahmud, whose empire once stretched from what is now northwestern Iran to Punjab. It used to have 32 towers, but many are now gone or ruined. Local people say this largest tower was badly damaged last year in a Taliban offensive on Ghazni and finally collapsed this week after heavy rains. Money had been given for restoration work, but sadly, that's now too late.
Jill McGivering. Pope Francis has warned his diplomats that they should not criticise him behind his back. He was speaking days after an archbishop, Carlo Vigano, repeated allegations that the Pope helped a former cardinal who'd been accused of sexual abuse. John McManus reports.
On Monday, retired Archbishop Carlo Vigano's latest attack on the Pope was revealed in a series of emails to the Washington Post. He accused the head of the Catholic Church of blatantly lying when he denied any knowledge of sexual abuse allegations against a former American cleric, Theodore McCarrick. Mr. McCarrick has since been defrocked by Pope Francis, but Archbishop Vigano maintains that the Pope had initially helped him. Now, Francis has told a gathering of over 100 Vatican diplomats that they should not criticise him behind his back, engage in gossip, or join groups hostile to him or the church.
John McManus. 10 years ago, researchers in California launched a unique scientific project to track the life histories of some of the oldest and tallest trees in the world. They want to find out why some of the giant species in Yosemite National Park are dying prematurely. The project aims to follow a 25-hectare plot over many decades, possibly centuries, as the study is passed on to future generations of researchers. The first decade has already seen dramatic changes in the forest, with wildfires and drought taking their toll, as Peter Bowes has been finding out.
Yosemite National Park, a vast and breathtaking expanse of forest land nestled in California's Sierra Nevada mountains. When I came here in 2009, researchers were mapping this plot of forest, counting and measuring the trees, mostly sugar pines and white firs.
We have one person that moves ahead of us and tags the tree, puts a tag on it, and we measure the tree, call the species identity.
3.84.
And then we map it, and that's what I'm doing right here. So
the plan was to return every year to track the trees through time, tagging new growth and doing what the scientists call a mortality assessment, noting the trees that have died and the reasons they perished.
Yeah, we're looking at the inside bark of a very long-dead sugar pine.
The lead researcher is Dr. Jim Lutz, an associate professor of forest ecology at Utah State University.
5 years into the project in 2013, we experienced a fire.
Those fuels now have dried up terribly,
and now are just right for the fire to consume them.
The Rim Fire, named because it started near a scenic lookout point called the Rim of the World, burned for 9 weeks in 2013. It was caused by an illegal campfire that got out of control. As it encroached on the plot, forest managers decided to start a so-called backfire to head off the full might of the approaching inferno.
We are in the Rockefeller Grove, Jim's big plot. It is the 28th of August.
A backfire that the National Park Service lit to check the advance of the Rim Fire, at the time the largest fire in the Sierra Nevada of California. And then immediately following the fire, we had two very, very strong drought years. Very, very dry.
And the distance is about 0.24 meters.
Sarah Germain joined the field crew shortly after the big fire.
Today my role is to remeasure all of the trees that are alive, to compare it to the measurements that we took right after the fire to see how much they've grown. And a lot of them have actually shrunk because a lot of the cambium was killed in the fire and they're losing bark. And then also to re-find every single tree that's tagged, over 30,000 stems.
It's right down there, isn't it, if I remember rightly?
A kilometre away are the 35,000 trees.
We're hiking deep into the plot, the forest vistas every bit as awe-inspiring as they were a decade ago, even with many dead and decaying trees around us.
The tags are at 1.37 metres.
I've kept a note of some of the trees and their tag numbers from my first visit, curious to see if they've survived.
So here it is. Here's the tag. You can see same tag as what was fresh 10 years ago, and we can see the discoloration by the heat of the fire, even though it's stainless steel.
And you see the evidence of the burning on the tree here.
Evidence of the burning on the bark, and then a little bit of sap, the tree responding to some wounds probably caused by the fire.
After 10 years, the researchers have a deeper understanding of the forest and the fine line between life and death. Fires and droughts can both help and hinder this complex ecosystem.
Here in this plot, the big trees, those with a diameter more than a meter, almost none of them died in the fire, maybe two or three. But the drought and the bark beetles combined to kill at least a third of the big trees. And those are trees that would have lived at least 300 years.
This long-term science project is still in its infancy. Researchers plan to return to Yosemite as long as they're able, gradually handing over the study to the forest ecologists of the future, however uncertain that future may be.
That report by Peter Bowes in Yosemite National Park in California. Now, are you sitting comfortably? Well, here's a short story on how the zebra got its stripes.
The burns from the fire left black marks on his snow-white coat. From that day on, the zebras wore their stripes with pride as a symbol of the struggle to make sure the water was free for all of the animals. The end.
That's just one of many conflicting tales, and it's a mystery that's puzzled scientists for years too. Camouflage is a common theory, but now zoologists have a new idea, that the stripes act as an elaborate calling system. The research was carried out by the naturalist Alison Cobb and her husband, Stephen Cobb, a zoologist from the University of Nairobi. I asked them via Skype about their study and what prompted them to embark on it.
I knew that zebras stand out in the blazing sun. They probably get extremely hot. And I thought, looking at the stripes, that the black ones are going to get hotter than the white ones, and I'd love to measure them.
So tell us about how you went about doing that and what you found.
Well, we didn't have any money for funding or anything, so I realised we couldn't afford thermal imaging cameras or Schlieren photography, that we needed to be able to get close enough to a zebra to hold a thermometer above its stripes. And I found that you could tame one. You could tame it by brushing it.
So, Stephen, that enabled you to discover that there was the big temperature differential between the white and the black stripes. And then what did you then go on to find as a result of that?
We measured the temperature differential on two zebras in Kenya. And what we pieced together was a story about zebra sweating and what happens at the tips of the hair. What has happened since we were there gathering these measurements is that a new protein associated with horse sweat has been discovered. It's called latherin, and it acts like a detergent and thins out the sweat of any horse and also of zebras, so that the sweat can leave the skin and move to the hair tips. When it gets to the hair tips, it finds an air that is disturbed by the rising hot air of black stripes and the descending cool air above the white stripes, turbulent air. And that air enables the sweat to evaporate more efficiently. And the other thing that whilst we were there, we were able to confirm is that, very surprisingly, zebras erect their black hairs whilst their white hairs remain flat and close to the skin. So three things are happening. They're sweating. The sweat is transported by this protein lathrin to the tips. It gets there more easily because of the erected black hairs. And when it gets to the surface, it finds this micro-turbulent air, which facilitates the evaporation.
And Alison, this also goes some way to explaining why it is that certain flies are put off landing on zebras. They're not dazzled by the stripes. They're put off by the airflow, I suppose.
Fascinatingly, other people's very good research has shown that the flies approach the zebra and veer off at the last moment. And my husband Steve had a private pilot's license, flew a tiny little aeroplane, and used to say, when you're coming into the threshold of a landing strip, which is that bit with black and white stripes on it, got a little aeroplane, you go around the side, or you come in high up, because the turbulent air from those two stripes will throw you all over the place.
That was the naturalist Alison Cobb and her zoologist husband, Stephen Cobb. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles. Until next time, goodbye.